Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I'm Justin Chisholm, and my guest this time is American Olympic silver medalist and renowned performance coach, Morgan Rieser. Morgan won a silver medal in the 470 class at the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona, sailing with the legendary Kevin Burnham, and has since coached the Greek women's and British men's pairings to Olympic gold and silver respectively, as well as establishing himself as a sought-after performance coach across a range of classes from small one-design keelboats to TP52s. Morgan has a treasure chest of great stories from his long career in yachting, and he's always a good interview, so I know you're really going to enjoy our chat. Morgan Rieser, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. It's great to have you on. You're one of the hardest working sailors and coaches around. You've a busy schedule, so thanks for taking the time. I think you're talking to me from Florida today.
I am. I'm in my home in Fort Lauderdale, thankfully.
So is this a busy time of year for you as a coach?
It is, and I kind of have a rare opportunity. There have been a number of regattas in South Florida. Normally, this is a quiet time of year with everyone starting to go north on the East Coast. But the Melgus 20 Worlds will be in a week and a half in Fort Lauderdale, and we just had the Etchells Nationals this week. So the sailors are lucky to be here.
Is it more fun for you coaching at a local venue? I mean, you must know that venue like the back of your hand. You were born there, right?
I was born and raised here, and it's a gift and a curse because you get a little too comfortable and think you know what's going on instead of actually looking more often.
Right, and the old adage of it's not normally like this here as well. That must come into play.
Yeah.
So I always like to ask my guests about how they got into sailing, how they became part of this sport. It's a sport you've been, like most of the guests on the podcast, it's been part of your life since you were pretty young, I'm guessing. But can you take us back to that? Do the who, when, what, where, what boat?
Yeah, actually, I love telling that story because it just brings back great memories. I grew up in Coconut Grove. And I remember I could hear the announcements from Coral Reef Yacht Club for the Dockmaster from, when I was a little kid. But I never went to the club, wasn't interested in sailing. And when I was 9, my mother said, "You are going to sailing camp." And I said, "No, I want to keep playing baseball." And she said, "Nope." And I remember crying, going, "I don't want to do that." And so off I went. And the first day we stayed on shore and learned the parts of the boat and how to tie knots. And the next day, off we were pushed into Biscayne Bay. And I still remember the feeling of the water going by the sides of the little Opti and the wind in my face. And I remember, the coaches or instructors, yelling, "Pull in your sail and head up." And I thought, they're not yelling at me. I'm not looking back. And it was just a wonderful day. And I have 4 sons, and my oldest two, when they started sailing on the first day, they fell asleep because they were just so relaxed and at ease.
Did they take to it? Is this a sailing dynasty we've got coming up?
Oh, here? I wouldn't go that far. My wife was an Olympian for Ireland, and my older two sons are sailors, and my younger two are tennis players so far. So anyway, they're both good life sports.
Yeah, but are there family sailing holidays for the Rieser family?
Actually, we don't even really do holidays. It seems like we end up going to Ireland for a change of pace and see the relatives there. But it seems like we're always on the move.
So that was your introduction to sailing. What is it that's kept you in the sport? You obviously fell in love with it from day one, but that's that's not always the case for people with the sport. People can often try a sport as a child and then give it up in later life.
I think it was lucky, and I try to pass this on to my athletes. You don't want to peak too early. You want to peak at the right time. And I sailed optimists, and certainly in most of the world, the parents get involved and they're pushing their kids and they want to see them, peak at 13. And my parents, you know, just dropped me off and picked me up at the end of a sailing day. And they just said, did you have a good time? There was never any quiz about results or why aren't you doing better? And I was also lucky to be surrounded by an amazing core of sailors in Miami, Alan Lindsay, Pete Melvin, Rick Merriman, and they were all champions in their own right. And I got to watch what they did and learn from them. So my peak was a ways off.
So it sounds like you didn't come from a sailing family. So pretty interesting that they decided to put you into sailing camp.
Yeah, I think my mother just wanted to get me out of the house, and that was the closest venue to send me off to. But my father knew how to sail, and you know now he's or you know in the recent past he's been a passionate cruiser. So he's had in the mid 80s he bought a Moody 33 in the south coast of the UK, and literally you know cruised every harbor from Greece to Gibraltar in the Med, and then around the top of Norway, and you know really hadn't missed anything. So he's a passionate yachtsman, just not a racer.
Wow! So ultimately you've become a sailing family. So plot that course then for me through from the sailing camp. Did you then join the yacht club and start to when did you start to race, and what were the boats you were involved with then?
Optimus, and I just kind of tagged along with what the older and better kids did in my area, and I got to go to two Optimus Worlds in 76 and 77, which really dates myself. Most of my athletes now go, I wasn't even born. And we had an amazing coach, Mark Muller, who was supportive but never satisfied. You know, always pushing us to do more and try harder and push the edges. And he was great. And I still remember his, you know, rules of thumb from way back then. And, I listened and watched. And, you know, finally, I would say my best regatta, I won the Optimus North Americans. And that was my last regatta in Optis. So, you know, I certainly didn't peak too early.
The way sailing is set up over in the States, I think, is different to in a lot of countries. Back then, what did it look like when you went off to a Worlds? Was it you were kind of taken away as part of a junior team, or did parents go along? How did it all work?
Yeah, we were a group of 10 sailors, five that were on the team and five alternates who could do some of the superfluous regattas around the worlds, the open worlds, and I can't remember what the other events are called. And yeah, the parents came, and back then in the U.S., the only place there were Optis was Miami and St. Petersburg, and that was it. So, you know, everybody were friends that we saw every few weekends, and parents were friends. So it was a great opportunity to see the world and, hang out with people you enjoyed.
Did you have any aspirations at that point beyond just sailing your Opti and, you know, enjoying it?
No, I was a simple kid.
So what happened next? You leave the Optis having won that regatta. Did that kind of mark you as somebody with potential, somebody who needed to be?
No. I was there were still kids that were a lot better than I was. Alan Lindsay went to five worlds and he got third in one world, so went to two youth world championships. Pete Melvin won the youth worlds with straight first. Nobody's done that since. So, you know, wow. I was not going to get to that point, but I crewed in 420s for a year and did very well domestically. And then I started steering a 420. And since I hadn't steered in a year, I thought, oh my, do I know how to do this? Do I remember anything? You know, that was another challenge. And then it was, you know, before I knew it, I was off to university. And I went to the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. And, you know, once again, I was really lucky. The facilities there are spectacular. And had Tom Kinney, a committed, detail-oriented, really supportive coach. and a great team around me. And that's where I started getting it. The first year I sailed in college, I was an unguided missile. Winning regattas, usually getting in a protest, usually getting thrown out. And in the nationals, I was one of the favorites and I ended up finishing dead last.
Wow.
So my next move was, I was, as you have to at Kings Point, you have to go out to sea for a semester on a ship. So I was going to be away from sailing for 6 months. But our coach, Tom Kinney, was named coach for the British University's team race tour that summer. And he thankfully was able to get me on the team. I was the youngest one there. And so I got to defer my going to sea for a month or so. But I got to spend a month, you know, every day in the van and in the boats with the sailors that beat me handily at the nationals. Jonathan McKee, Petey Dickey, Nevin Sayre. And, you know, I learned from them. And right. I saw the commitment and the, you know, detail orientation that they had and I didn't at the time. So, you know, I spent the next 4.5 months on a ship, pretty much alone. There was one other student on the ship. And one ship I spent the most time on, it was a 1,000-foot, it was called a lash container ship. And we ended up going all the way around the world through the Panama Canal twice, through the Suez.
Wow.
And, you know, I had the guy that won the nationals, Petey Dickey, I had his picture up on the mirror in my room. And, you know, every day I thought about beating him. And the thing that I hated to do most in life was run. Just really did not enjoy running. So I went running every day on the ship down below decks.
Really?
You know, jumping through watertight doors and and one lap of the ship was a mile. So, or two laps was a mile. So I just did, you know, multiple laps down below decks and of something that I hated. And yeah. When I came back in the spring to sail again, you know, I hadn't sailed in the better part of 6 months. But, you know, I'd pushed myself harder than I'd ever pushed myself, mentally and physically, and showed up and I won the first regatta and I won the second regatta and got to the nationals and won by 27 points.
Wow.
But I knew that I had worked harder than anyone else in the fleet. So I took confidence from that, even though I hadn't raced the whole previous season. So that was kind of my breakthrough moment of beginning to figure out what works.
Yeah. And that class was 420s?
Yeah, we sailed 420s and Larks and Flying Juniors and, you know, whatever the local university had where we were competing.
But the championship that you won was in 420s?
Flying Juniors, actually, in Alamitos Bay, California.
So just for, I think I remember those boats. They were kind of like the training boat for the Flying Dutchman, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They used to have spinnakers and, you know, they had rake control going upwind, but the college ones are, you know, everything's locked off, no spinnakers and, you know, just simple.
Yeah. Still a kind of tricky boat to sail. I don't think you see many of those around anymore.
No, and it was funny. We sailed in a relatively light air venue, flat water in a harbor in Long Beach, and I had the only male crew in the whole regatta. Everyone else had little diminutive girls. And I had my Opti partner, Alan Lindsay, sailing with me. And I remember sailing out to the first race. I was saying, Alan, you know, that guy's won this nationals, this guy's won this nationals. And the last person I pointed out was Dave Chapin. And I said, he's the current Sunfish world champion. And Alan looked at me seriously. He goes, good thing we're not sailing Sunfish, huh?
Good answer. Yeah. Put that out of your head straight away. So how did you progress towards the 470, the boat that you ultimately would have your Olympic success in?
I bought a 470 thinking that, you know, I would have time to go sailing a, you know, old used boat and sailed it a bit, but, you know, got distracted with other things. And every year there was a 470 midwinters in Miami, and back then the 470 class was a pretty big deal. And in 1985, Kevin Burnham, who I'd sailed a 420 Midwinters with way back when, called me up and said, "Hey, do you want to do this Midwinters?" And he was, you know, he was an amazing crew back then, been to the Worlds numerous times, and I jumped at the opportunity. And he said, "The only problem is we got a boat in my backyard that's pretty beat up." So, you know, I spent the better part of a week trying to sand the bottom and fill cracks, and I knew nothing about 470s compared to Kevin. So, you know, I just drove the boat. Kevin set the thing up, told me where to go, and we won the regatta, qualified for the Worlds, and wow. You know, I was off. Whether I knew it or not, I was off.
Was that a shock?
It was a nice surprise. You know, Petey Dickey, who was the tuning partner for Steve Benjamin for the 84 games, was there, and you know, it was a big fleet. So yeah, I was thrilled to be able to win with Kevin, a good friend.
So what was the conversation after that regatta then?
Kevin said, "Well, guess we got to go to the Worlds," and so we bought a hull at Parker's on the east coast of the UK and went there. And back then, you know, nobody told me there was an easier way to do it, but back then they said, "Nope, you got to go put all the fittings on the boat yourself." So we spent the better part of a week, you know, screwing fittings on, and Kevin spent the better part of 2 days just putting one turning block on, because his favorite tool was a hammer. So there wasn't a lot of detail with that. So we were still rigging the boat when we got to Marina di Carrera in Italy, and you know, that whole regatta was a bit of a blur, trying to get the boat together and get it measured at the last minute and hope it holds together, and sailing in a, you know, 100 plus boat fleet, and we ended up finishing 10th,
right?
So, you know, and almost won a race. We finished second, and all of a sudden I thought, hey, we can actually do this.
Yeah. And obviously Kevin was the one with all of the kind of expertise. Did you find yourself growing in confidence though, kind of each regatta you did? I mean, the 10th in the Worlds must have given you a bit of a boost.
Yeah. And there was, I think it was the third or fourth race in the regatta. Actually the second race in the regatta, Kevin said, "We need to watch those guys, the Chieffe brothers." He said, they were top five in the last Olympics and this is their home club. So we need to watch them. So we started following them around at 4 minutes before the start. And at 3:30, they parked right next to the committee boat. We tacked under them and we figured they were going to do a few more loops around, but that was it. That was the final approach. We were about a boat length off the line at 3:30. And we stayed there next to them and other people would come up and bang into them and they'd start pushing boats back around them. And we started the race to leeward them. They tacked, we tacked. They were first to the weather mark. We were fourth. And Kevin goes, "See, this works."
Local knowledge, right?
Yeah. Well, as my son Benjamin said in his first Opti regatta, he said, "I knew who the good guys were. And Dad, I followed them."
Yeah, so, that's not a bad strategy.
At some point during the regatta, you know, I said, "You know what? I was a good starter in college. And the pin ends favored. And I think we can win the pin." And we won the pin, tacked across the fleet, first to the weather mark. Chieffe passed us after that. But, it was a confidence building event for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So from then you built into a kind of formal campaign, I'm guessing. But when did the prospects of the Olympics arise? Was it always about the Olympics?
It was. And you know, I remember back, I think it must have been the 72 Olympics. I was watching, maybe it was the 10,000 meters. And there was an American named Dave Waddle, who was, you know, he wasn't a favorite, but he was good. And I remember watching the race and the world champion favored Russian stumbled and fell right at the finish line. And Dave Waddle was second. He ended up winning, completely surprised. And the Russian literally crawled on his hands and knees across the finish line to get second. And at the medal ceremony, Dave Waddle kept his, you know, kind of captain's hat on when he got up on the medal stand. And I remember watching that moment and, you know, getting teary-eyed And I could just feel all the effort and passion that he'd put into it. And, you know, even now I think about that moment and I start getting teared up. So the Olympics for me is, you know, kind of the pinnacle in sport. And I speak to other sailors and, you know, they've grown up, you know, visualizing about the America's Cup or the Whitbread race. And that's what their passion is. But for sure, mine's the Olympics.
So how did you start to put that whole plan into place?
It was a very disjointed plan at that point. I ended up doing the 88 trials with one of my college teammates, Jay Renahan, and Kevin sailed with Steve Benjamin. And we finished second in the trials, which is the worst place to finish. And John Chadden and Charlie McKee went off and got a bronze medal at the Olympics in 88 in Korea. And I called Kevin up, or Kevin called me up after that, and he said, let's do it again. And so we started sailing again and, you know, really enjoyed every minute with him. And, you know, with Kevin, I was an only child, and every time we'd have an argument. We were quite different people. He's super outgoing and I was relatively quiet. And when we'd have a disagreement, he'd say, the only reason this is happening is because you're an only child. And he's and he'd say, I am the brother you never had. And I would say, you're the brother I never wanted. So we'd end up laughing about it. So even though we were different, we got on really, really well. And ended up winning the 92 Olympic trials. And right after we won, Kevin said, this is my dream. I finally won the trials. And I said, Kevin, this is, you know, the hard part is still in front of us. And it was a pretty short period. I think we won the trials in late April and the games were in July in Barcelona. So it was full rush after that to even begin to think we were Olympians.
Yeah.
Let alone prepare properly.
Just let me ask you, when you say win the trials, what did the trials look like back then? If it was a movie, it would all go down to the final race of the...
And it did. It came down... Well, actually, it came down to the second last race, because the only people that could beat us were John Chadden and Charlie McKee, the guys that had thrashed us in the previous trials. And they were, you know, well ahead of us at the first mark, and we ground back and won the final race that we had to sail in, so we didn't have to do the last race. But, you know, an amazing moment, and you know, it was kind of one step along the way, but thankfully we had a really experienced coach in Skip White who tried to keep us grounded and always one step ahead. So we couldn't have done it without him, that's for sure.
So you said it was a quick turnaround and off to Barcelona for the Olympics. Did that help or hinder you? Can you remember what you felt at the time? It would be nice to be selected early, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, we couldn't go to the Worlds that year in 92 because the trials were where they were. So Jordi Calafat and Kiko Sanchez won the Worlds handily in Cadiz, I think. And our next regatta was the Europeans in Belgium. And so we ended up having a really good regatta in Belgium. I remember we were second the first two races, beat Jordi both races. And Kevin ended up in his outgoing way. Jordi and Kiko were pretty reserved and quiet. And Kevin goes, I'm going to go over and talk to those guys. And we ended up becoming friends with him. And I remember Jordi saying, why didn't you do the Worlds in Cadiz? And we said, oh, we're busy with the trials. And he goes, you would have won the Worlds. So there were little things like that that, you know, kind of slowly built our confidence. And I certainly did a lot of visualization, you know, putting myself in positions during the Olympics, starting, rounding marks, doing well, and even watching myself step up on the medal stand. And we got to spend a good part of 2 weeks before the game sailing every day with Jordi and Kiko, you know, the world champions and favorites for the gold medal. And, you know, we were as fast or faster than they were. So even though we'd never finished probably better than fifth in an international event, we went into the games thinking we were one of the two favorites.
And you were.
Yes. Yeah. It was a problematic event, though. We started out pretty darn well, and midway through the event, we sailed our discard. And back then, there were only eight races, you know, long courses, triangle, windward, leeward, triangle, windward, which kids now just can't believe, one race a day. And you couldn't see the jibe mark a lot of times if there were waves, so you had to navigate to it, get your compass headings down before you started. And so we sailed our discard and went from second overall to fifth overall with two races to go. And I thought, you know, is our chance over? And, you know, the U.S. support staff was positive and wonderful. And our physio, who wasn't even a sailor, said, Morgan, it's just like practice. Get a clear start, hit the first shift. And I'm thinking, he doesn't even know how to sail, but he's right. That's all it is. So we had two good races to end the regatta. And you know, going into the final race of that games, two teams could win a gold medal, five teams could win the bronze medal, eight teams could win the bronze. And we were one of the two that could win the gold. So Skip gave us his spreadsheet taped to the side of the boat, which, jeez, you know, who had to finish where, and Kevin and I didn't even look at it. It was so complicated. So Jordy's only job was to screw us in the pre-start. So we're, you know, circling around with him, trying to look for an avenue of where we wanted to start. And we escaped from Jordy and had a collision with the Belgians, port starboard there on port. And the whole fleet ends up sailing past us while we're extricating ourselves from the collision. And I remember we were, I think, 26th at the first weather mark.
Ouch.
But thankfully, we still had a long course to go. And Kevin just looked at me and said, Tiger, we got some work to do. There was no panic. And gradually, we passed boats. And at the upwind finish, you know, I remember the horns were honk, 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 as, you know, we finished with two other boats either side of us. And Kevin looked at me and he said, how'd we do? And I looked back at that spreadsheet, and the people that were well behind us in the medal race were in front of us in the race. And the you know, it was too close to even call. I said, Kev, I have no idea. And a boatload full of photographers came up and took pictures of us and waved and cheered. And Kevin said, how do we do? I said, Kev, I still don't know. And the one team that I knew we beat, the Norwegians, who were third going into the last race, I knew we beat them. And Kevin and they're good friends, and Kevin looked over at Herman and said, Herman, how did we do? And I was about to say, Kevin, no, don't ask him. And Herman looked over and said, my friends, I'm so proud of you. I think you won the silver medal. So just great sportsman, great friend. And so we had about a 45-minute sail upwind to get back into the harbor. And Kevin must ask me six or seven times on the way in, how'd we do? So it wasn't until literally we got to the dock and all the American sailors and support staff were on the end of this floating dock, and it was literally sinking. And the head of the Federation, I grabbed him and I said, how did we do? And Mike said, you won the silver medal. So, you know, it was a long delay from finish to
wow. Yeah.
To understanding. And then Skip came up and said, you know, there's this one protest, and if they win the protest, we weren't involved, they'll move up one and you won't, and you'll get the bronze medal, or you might not even get the bronze medal. Oh. And Kevin just said, Skip, stop it. So there was no protest, and the medals weren't given out until that evening, and they built a purpose-built beautiful dock out in the middle of the Olympic Harbor with the podium on there. And it was at sunset, and the 470s were the final medal that was given out. So I was waiting the whole time for someone up to come up and tap me on the shoulder and said, I'm sorry, we made a mistake. And the eighth or ninth medal that was given out were the Tornado catamarans, and the French had won, the Americans were second. and the Randy Smythe and Keith Notary went to shake the hands of the French that were just above them on the podium. And when they did shake hands, they grabbed the French and threw them off the medal stand into the harbor. And Jordy looked over at us and he goes, "Please don't do that to us." And Kevin goes, "We're throwing you in." And Kevin goes, "The king is here. It'll be very embarrassing."
So they hung the medal around your necks. I've got to ask, what did that feel like?
Well, just backtracking a little, back then, being part of the U.S. team, even if you were us and had only finished fifth in an international event before, almost still made you a favorite for a medal, just because the U.S. had such a great legacy of Olympic performance. In the 84 games, they won 7 of 7 medals. And so in Barcelona, you know, we were around another great team. And in the end, the U.S. won 9 of 10 medals. So 1 gold, 6 silver, and a bronze, I think, if I have the count right. And so, you know, we were just one of another many great performances. So it was really special being part of that team, because everybody was pulling for the team next to them. And, you know, you just felt like you were going to win a medal because you were around so many other great teams. And that's kind of how the British are now.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because they've got such a great legacy.
I was just about to say that it sounds very much, as I've witnessed with the British team in recent years, particularly in London 2012, which we'll come on to in a sec because you were kind of involved in that as well. So you win a medal at the Olympics. Did you feel any sort of, all right, that's done, tick that off, or was it, we need to go again?
Not that we need to go again, but darn it all, Justin, it was so much fun. It was, I've coached 5 or 6 games now, I kind of lost count. I see so many athletes that are just paralyzed by the expectation of a games, of a peak event in your life. And the Olympics I've done, whether it's as a coach or a sailor, have been the funnest events I've ever done in my life. So, you know, and I, you know, since we went into that games, there was no expectation. You know, nobody, apart from probably Jordy, and Skip and Kevin, counted us as favorites. So we had zero expectation. It was just execution and enjoy the opportunity.
So what did happen next? What was the...
Well, the next games were home games. The Olympics were in Atlanta, Georgia. Sailing was in Savannah, Georgia. And Savannah's, you know, there's not a whole lot of sailing there. And what sailing there is up the river, far from the coast. So it was a brand new venue. There was, you know, there weren't even any facilities to really get out to the ocean. So the foreign teams had, you know, as much knowledge of the venue as we did. We were starting from scratch. And, you know, it was an amazing place to sail. Really dependable sea breeze, and kind of character building venue with all the insects to overcome. But even Kevin and I sailed better in Savannah than we did in Barcelona. We had a bit of bad luck getting an OCS in a race that we won on second to last day. Otherwise, it would have been another silver medal. But I tell everyone that I actually won a gold medal in Savannah, because that's where I met my wife, Louise. But I think I've said that too often, so it really doesn't resonate with her anymore.
But it is a great story, so because you did meet there. So tell us about that. It's the Olympics. Surely you should be focused on the sailing and the racing.
I was.
Not romancing.
And I had two really good friends by my side, with Kevin on the boat, and Larry Suter was our coach. So... You know, I'd grown up with both of them in Miami. And, you know, we, in Savannah before that games, the Seabreeze was so desperately dependable. And for probably 2 weeks before the games, we won every single practice race we sailed in. So we went into that games with even more confidence than we had in Barcelona. And during the games, all of a sudden, the venue was thunderstorms and intermittent sea breeze. And so, unfortunately, we were still on our same, you know, racetrack of doing exactly what the sea breeze demanded when it really wasn't a sea breeze. So we did a bit of stumbling and bumbling. And at the end of the games, the sea breeze filled in again, and we had, you know, all top five finishes apart from our OCS. And, you know, kind of fought till the end. And at the end of the day, the Great Sailors still won the medals. We were close. But it's that games frustrated me a lot because it was a home games. It should have been something that we should have overachieved or peaked at better because we were the home team. And I was lucky because since then I've had a number of home games to coach at, in Athens in 2004 as a Greek coach and London 2012. So I think I've compensated for my my initial stumble in Savannah, but
absolutely,
for sure there's a big difference between doing a home games as an athlete and being a visitor.
I want to come on to those two Olympics in a second and how you moved into coaching. But so at this point, you're two Olympics in, you have a medal. How much did having the medal change your sailing life? Were you suddenly besieged with offers to go and do high paid sailing gigs, or was it different back then?
Well, I went back to school and got a master's in business in between the 92 and 96. And, you know, I didn't see myself as sailing being my profession. I figured I'd use my engineering and business background. And so, you know, there were offers, but, you know, I figured I'd stick with my normal career path that I envisioned myself doing after sailing was over. But somehow sailing hung on to me for a bit. And after 96, Kevin and I got a real job. I worked for a company called Tides Marine as an engineer. I was a first employee hired startup company. And, you know, we made innovative marine products, as we said. But we had some self-aligning rudder bearings that both Team New Zealand and Dennis Conner used in the America's Cup Finals. So that was kind of shot in the arm going, yeah, great, I'm using my education. And then I ran a manufacturing company, a pump manufacturing company, for 9 years. And the company was effectively bankrupt when we got it. So that was an uphill battle. Everyone hated us. My first day at work, the employees hadn't been paid. Customers didn't get their product. Suppliers hadn't been paid. So we ended up, you know, the goal was make the company profitable in 3 years. We did that, but we're growing so quickly. I hung in there and ended up doing the 2000 trials, you know, in a half-assed effort. And we're beaten by Paul Forrester and Bob Merrick, and they won a silver medal. And so Kevin was off then sailing with Paul Forrester, and I got a call from George Andriatis, you know, an amazing sailor himself, but, you know, an unbelievably generous person for sailing, good friend of Ding Schoonmaker's, an equally generous person for the sport of sailing. And George said, would you be interested in coaching Sofia Beccatoro and Amelia Souffla? They have a great chance, and they'd won the previous three 470 worlds and, you know, stumbled in the Sydney Olympics. And, you know, I jumped at the chance.
Right.
So I literally started a year before the games with them. Not even. Probably 8 months before the games.
So that was giving up what you were doing and moving on to that full time.
Yeah, well, no, it wasn't full time. I still had a company to run, but at that point, you know, the key employees were in place, and you know, the key employees were making more money than I was and doing a great job. So there was a time where I could step away.
All right. So how do you approach that then? Your first coaching role, as far as we've worked out from this conversation, how do you go into the how do you treat that when these guys have won three world championships already?
Well, I knew of them, but I didn't know them well. So the first thing I did was go back through results and mark roundings from previous Olympics, including the ones I sailed. And then you can still go online and look at, you know, the mark rounding order of, you know, race to first leeward gate in 1996 and see where people were. And I thought in my innocence, there must be some analytics I can leverage on to use in my coaching, something that works. Because at the end of the day, we have a desperately potentially confusing sport with all the variables. You know, our venue changes by the day and by the minute. And some people get paralyzed with all the variables. But, you know, if you know or one knows the few priorities for that day and you get those right, you're going to have a good day. So in looking at the results, I finally came to the realization that going through multiple classes and multiple Olympics, that if all you do is average rounding the weather mark in the top 10% of the fleet, so fleet of 30, you average rounding 10th. And in total, after mark one, you pass one boat for the whole regatta, all races combined, and you get no letters in your score, no DSQs, OCSs. You win an Olympic medal. And it seems like a desperately low threshold to do, but, you know, it's a consistent thing across classes, across Olympics, and it's normally only the three medal winners that satisfy those three things. So that's what I started with, to try to just simplify the thing. And the other thing I did in speaking with Sophia and Millie was to chat with them about their previous Olympic experience going in as favorites. And they did not enjoy the Olympic experience. They said, we felt like we stayed at the team house and didn't go to the opening ceremonies and didn't enjoy the Olympic experience. So I said, we are going to have fun. And, you know, as I remembered, I did, you know, I loved the opening ceremonies. I was not about to miss it. And so in Athens, the 470's first race was the morning after the opening ceremonies. And I think the Greeks might've been the only 470 sailors that went.
Right.
And, you know, my old mentor was coaching the Danish girls, one of the other medal favorites. And he said, you are crazy to let them go. They're going to be exhausted. And so I was, apart from Bruce Kendall, the only non-American Greek coach in the team. He was the windsurfer coach for Nikos Kakamanakis, a medal favorite. And so he told me, he said, my athlete has a, he said he has a surprise at the opening ceremonies. And I said, I know what it is. He's going to read the Olympic oath to the athletes. And so we're waiting for, you know, the Olympic torch to come into the stadium. And, you know, it was pretty cool again to be the final team walking into the opening ceremonies as the host nation. And so Bruce and I were decided that we weren't going to be the first in. Clearly the other Greek teams were athletes were going to be in the front. So we figured we'd be the last. And so we held back and the, you know, eight wide marching team of Greek athletes and coaches gradually tapered. And finally, Bruce and I were the last two. And finally, a British guy who was one of the producers, clearly TV producers during the Olympics, came over and said, clearly you guys are enjoying yourselves, but we're waiting for you. Could you please hurry up? So Bruce and I were waiting to see who ran by with the Olympic torch. And all of a sudden, Nikos, his athlete, ran by with the Olympic torch.
Wow.
That was his surprise. And, you know, and up the stairs he went. And so Sophia was there watching the whole thing. And she got, you know, police escort in and out from the ceremonies with Nikos. So she didn't lose much sleep. And the next day they had a 1-2 on the first day. And, you know, the two of them utterly enjoyed the games. Absolutely enjoyed it.
And they ended up with which medal?
Gold medal with two races to spare.
Amazing. Amazing. Were you confident in them going into that regatta? They could do that?
Yeah, I was. But the one big stumbling block we had at the first Worlds, the only Worlds I coached them, you know, they'd won the previous three Worlds easily, and clearly they were the favorites. And I think it was race three, they were doing well, and gradually they dropped back in the fleet and finished 26th. So I towed them in, disgusted. And when we got to the beach, I got their trolley, and Sophia, who was tough as nails and amazing physical shape, was crying. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I can't feel my leg." And she said, "I think it's my back." So we you know, called local authorities. They got an ambulance over, and you know, they were in touch with her doctor back in Athens. And I was talking to the Greek men that were there with me, the men's team, and Andreas and Kostas. And I said, "What are we going to do? We're in Zadar, Croatia." I said, "How are we going to get her back to Athens?" And they said, "Don't worry, Morgan." And I said, "What do you mean, don't worry?" I said, "How many plane changes is it going to take to get back there?" And they said, "Don't worry." I said, "What do you mean, don't worry? I feel like we're in the middle of nowhere here." And he said, "The Learjet's on the way." And I said, "What do you mean the Learjet's on the way?" He goes, "The army has sent a Learjet to pick her up."
Wow.
"And bring her back." Because she was, you know, a big fish in a small bowl. She was one of the few medal favorites in Greece for the games. So, and she was in the army. So she was whisked back, had an operation the next day. She had two collapsed vertebrae.
Oh.
And, you know, there went Palma, there went the air, there went all the training events before the games. And, you know, we kept in touch, and she was at a rehab facility mainly for football players in Germany. And, you know, she said, "I'm working on walking."
Jeez.
So I think 3 weeks before the games, I got back to Athens, and she was allowed, at the time when the rest of the world was out sailing all day, she was allowed to sail 20 minutes a day, her doctor said, and that's it. And before I went to Greece, I talked to our U.S. sports psychologist and asked him, I said, you know, what am I to expect with this injured athlete? And Jerry May was, you know, world famous sports psychologist. He worked with Monica Seles after she got stabbed when she came back. And he said, athletes try to come back too early, and they think they're indestructible, and they too often re-injure themselves. But Sophia was so focused and so committed an athlete, you know, after 5 days, she's done her 20 minutes, jumps in the water, does exercises in the water. And we had one of the Greek men sailors, he would jump in the boat at the weather mark. She'd do one windward leg, stop for the day. And so one of the Greek men sailors would jump into the weather mark and do the rest of the race with Millie to keep her crew work.
Wow.
Really
good. I've never read this story anywhere, Morgan. Is this... This doesn't seem to have been shared particularly. Was it shared at the time?
I mean, Sophia doesn't show weakness. So after 5 days, I said, "How are you feeling?" And she goes, "Great. I'm feeling really good." And I said, how about 40 minutes tomorrow? And she goes, "Not a chance, Morgan. Doctor said 1 week, 20 minutes. And she said, "If I get this wrong, I'm not going to walk again." So she said, "I'm not going to get this wrong." So as we got closer to the games, you know, the medical staff gave her more and more time to sail. And, you know, she said during the game, she said, I'm only 80%. But that's all she needed, to be honest. But mentally, she was, you know, tougher than everyone put together. And one of my challenges in working with them was that they were so confident in their boat handling that they were happy to go around the course one boat length ahead of someone they had to beat and stay there around every mark, not take a chance. So there were races in previous events where I'd say left side's going to be really strong. And they said, yep, we agree. And the fleet would go right. They'd be one of the five boats going left and they'd go back with the fleet and they'd round fifth at the weather mark behind the four boats that went left. And I'd say, what, why didn't you go left? You knew it was favored. And they said, we wanted to be in control of the fleet. And I said, there is going to be one race in the games where you know what to do and you have to stick with your confidence. Because if you don't win that race, it's going to be the difference between winning a medal and not winning a medal. And that went back to one race in Barcelona when Kevin and I won. If we hadn't won that race, there was no medal for us. And, you know, there was one race that was a breakthrough that put them, you know, just ahead to an insurmountable lead in Athens. But Sophia did say, she said, keep an eye on us. She said, if we capsize, I'm really worried about my back. And she said, I'm not sure. So please look out for me. And the last race they ended up sailing, they sailed across the finish line and capsized. And, you know, I was with another coach in the rib. And, you know, my immediate thought was, oh no, they're, you know, Sophia's back. So I dove in the water and we were quite a ways away from them. And, you know, I remember swimming through the beautiful blue Aegean waters and I could see them turtled upside down. I could see their mast and the sails just sitting there limp. And I swam over to the boat thinking, you know, Sophia's going to be laying in the water, you know, clutching her leg or her back. And I get there and there is so much noise. They're on the bottom of the boat with a Greek flag and, you know, everyone's cheering around them. I'm like, you've got to be kidding.
But now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's such fantastic, unique insight, Morgan. Thank you for that story. Let's contrast that a little bit. Your other, Olympic coaching, that was successful too was with the British pair, Luke Patience and Stu Bithell. Quite a different pair, I would imagine.
Yeah, and my beginning with the British, one of the other teams I remember watching thinking they're really good. Christina Bassadone was the helm. And, you know, I can't remember if she contacted me or I contacted her. But anyway, we got in contact and she said, will you coach us? And so, you know, that was my beginning with the British. And, you know, it was really impactful for me because the team is so professional, so highly organized, so supportive of each other. And, you know, I still say, even though I've done three games as a British coach, that, you know, maybe I was just oblivious being an American, being the only American on the team, that I didn't notice any politics. But it, you know, after 12 years with them, it was all about performance. You know, politics distracted no one. And the two Olympic directors on the team, Stephen Park, who started in Athens and ended in Rio, and then Mark Robinson, who I worked with for Tokyo, very different people, but both amazing leaders. So it was a pleasure to work with both of them, just true professionals committed to their job, and they outworked every athlete on the team.
So tell me about working with Luke and Stu.
You know, I met both of them when I was coaching Christina and Saskia for the 2008 games in China. And, you know, after my experience with the Americans in Barcelona with, you know, debatably the best Olympic performance ever, depending on how you look at it with number of medals, or the British in 2008 won 4 gold, 2 silver and a bronze. So if you go by number of golds, that was the best performance ever in Olympics by a country. And, you know, joy to be a part of that team. Christina and Sass were close to a medal. They ended up finishing 5th. So I wanted another chance to do it again and still be part of that amazing British team. And the fact that it was a home event for the British, that was, you know, another opportunity to overcome my mistakes from Savannah in 96. So I was offered by Sparky, who's not normally a generous person, but a very demanding person, the opportunity to coach the British 470 men. And that included Nick Rogers and Joe Glanfield, double silver medalists. It included Nick Asher and Elliot Willis, double world champions, and Luke Patience and Chris Grube, who were the youngsters. You know, they agreed to part ways, and Luke was kind of rudderless, jumping between different crews, and so just a few weeks before the 2009 Worlds that were in Denmark, he and Stu started practicing. Didn't even practice with the squad. I remember in Weymouth, they were off on their own capsizing and doing what they were doing. And, you know, they decided, well, let's try the Worlds. And they literally practiced about 6 days before the world started. And they sailed an amazing regatta. Luke is, you know, about as fast a driver in a 470 as I know. And Stu has more confidence than just about everyone put together with his strategy. Whether he's right or wrong, he is confident. Which is exactly what Luke wants to hear. It's confidence. And they ended up finishing 2nd in that Worlds, and they were off. And they beat the world champions and, you know, the Olympic medalists. So that was their beginning. Not what they expected at all. But so they spent the better part of the next year thinking, we put almost no work into that world. So that's what we're going to do for each succeeding regatta, is put almost no work into it. We're going to be the last out to the starting line. We're going to be so relaxed. And my effort was to convince them that you can't get away with that anymore. And they were happy to hit corners and take risks, that they did. And it all worked in Denmark at that Worlds. And so my goal after that was to make them more responsible. And, you know, like a lot of things in life, when you make a change, to find what works, you have to go past what works and say, okay, we went too far, let's bring it back again. So they missed out in 2011 at the test event, or to qualify for the test event, and they were beaten by Nick Rogers and Palm Green. And so, you know, all of a sudden they were in the back of the queue for Olympic selection, possible Olympic selection. And you know, we said, go off your confidence. Don't end up in the middle of the course. When you're highly confident, go for it. And, you know, they became, you know, more mature sailors, making great decisions, amazing middle of the line starters, and fast, always really fast. And so the final trials event, all the pressure on in the world, was the Worlds in Perth, and they ended up finishing a close 2nd and won the medal race going away, with Luke waving to the crowd halfway through the race, and off they were to the games. So our next event was Miami Olympic Classes Regatta, and they were still on their victory tour because they just gotten selected And we ended up dropping out of the regatta with a day to spare, going, we've lost our way again. We've got to get back on track. And to their credit, we spent the next day probably 8 hours sitting in a room mapping out what the program was going to be to win a medal. And instead of getting on the Olympic hamster wheel and going to Palma and going to Yair and going to the Europeans like everybody else does, we went completely off the track and decided to focus on just knowing Weymouth, because there were five possible courses we could race on. And every course was totally unique because of the wind and the geography involved. So we did Palma, but we spent the next 4 months sailing in Weymouth. And it turned out to be the windiest, rainiest spring on record in the UK. And Sparky, thankfully, bought into our plan and leveraged Nick Rogers and Nick Asher and Elliot Willis and a bunch of juniors, because he had the purse strings to control, and got them to come and train with us. And we got Gabriel Zeradano, the Italian selection. He bought into our plan as well. And we had a pretty darn good squad to train with there. And by the time the games started, every day we sailed in the games, there was no question what the best track was around the course. So they had full confidence. So that was, but they hated me for a while because, you know, Yair was a windy regatta. The Australians broke their mast and they thought we would have won Yair. And the Worlds turned out to be a windy regatta in Barcelona. And they thought, and Hannah and Saskia won the Worlds and got all kinds of fanfare, and they thought we would have won that Worlds. So they were absolutely disgusted with me for coming up with this plan for a while. But, you know, in the end, it worked.
In the end, it worked. So much of your job is not about sailing. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, I guess in looking at it, but for sure that I far more enjoy the regatta days than the training days.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. When you see your sailors on the podium having the medal put round their necks, like you did back in your day, how do you feel? Does it do you get the lump in the throat?
Well, I certainly did with Sophia and Millie. And I felt the exact same way because Kevin Burnham and Paul Forrester won the 470 men in Athens. And it was, you know, pretty unique in Athens back in 2004, because when Kevin and I sailed together, we decided pretty early on it didn't work for us to stay together during the regatta. So, you know, we'd split up and stay in different apartments with different people, and we'd come back to the boat, you know, not having frustrated each other in the evenings. Right. And so in Athens, in the massive Olympic marina that was constructed, it was supposed to be a cruise ship port. It was so big. And it turned out that the Greeks were right next to the Americans in this huge venue. And so Kevin and I went out to dinner literally every single night for over a month and really enjoyed each other's company. And you know, Kevin was desperately old school because, you know, he started sailing 470s in 1977, I think. So he was 49 years old in Athens, 47 years old. And, you know, he was the one back when there were lay days during the regatta that the lay day was for to recover from the big party the night before. And so he was all about enjoying the experience. And Paul and Kevin's training partners were the Koster brothers, great up-and-coming young Dutch team, really fast. And Kevin would counsel them because, you know, they would go out with Kevin and have fun at other regattas. And Kevin would say, when you get to the games, don't change what we're doing now. It's just another regatta. And so during the games, you know, their team leader said, in bed at 10 o'clock every night. So every night at 10 o'clock, Kevin would give them a call going, hey, what are you guys doing? And they're going, we're in bed. And Kevin and I would be, you know, out chatting with friends. And he said, I told you, don't change what you do. And so the restaurant we'd normally go to, it was a father and son little cafe. You know, Kevin, we'd have a few beers, and Kevin would tell the owner and his son, "I'm going to win a gold medal." And I'm sure they thought, A, you're way too old, and B, you're drinking way too much beer to win a gold medal. And so after the medal, the day after the medal ceremony, we went back for lunch, and Kevin brought t-shirts and the gold medal to show the guy, and they were amazed, absolutely amazed. So, you know, Kevin was all about the passion and enjoying the opportunity. So that's another thing I try to rub off on the sailors, is not to stay out drinking beer, but to enjoy the opportunity and not get paralyzed with expectation.
Now, I want to ask you about to compare and contrast the days, the glory days of that American Olympic team that you were part of, and the kind of lackluster, slightly barren medal performance we've seen from them over recent cycles. What's going on, and can it be fixed?
Yeah, it can be fixed. But, you know, clearly the big change is we've gone from, you know, full amateur operations. Because back then, the only professional employee on the U.S. team was Jonathan Harley, who handled the logistics for the team. And, you know, the Olympic director was a volunteer, and we pretty much did everything ourselves. And back then, if you were number one on the U.S. team, we got $1,200. So that paid for our plane ticket to the world. So Kevin and I, we'd usually do one international regatta a year. We'd go to the worlds, and that was it. Otherwise, we'd stay in the U.S. and go sailing against very few boats, or sail alone most of the time with no coach. So about the only time we had a coach was at the Olympics. So things have clearly changed. And, you know, after being a British coach and, you know, immersing myself with the team, one of the first questions I was asked by the other British coaches was, what football team do you support? And I said, actually, I don't. And they go, that's not an option. You need to support a team. And I said, well, I don't know who I should support. And they said, okay, we'll work on it. And the next day, Mark Howard came back and said, Liverpool, you're supposed to support Liverpool. And I said, okay, what do I know? What should I know about Liverpool? And they said, just one thing, Stevie Gerrard. So I said, okay, point taken. But, you know, as I did growing up as an Opti sailor, I did a lot of listening and tried to learn from the people around me, because, you know, the British had such, forget about the great sailors, the coaching staff was absolutely spectacular. With David Howlett, and the list just went on. Hamish Wilcox, and so I learned from the people around me, and we got to go, if you were lucky, Sparky would choose you to go to an elite coaches conference that UK Sport put on, and I got to go to that twice. And you got to choose for each hour, you got to choose one of five lectures to go listen to. And Duncan Truswell, who was running the junior team at the time for UK sailing, was giving a lecture. And I thought, I don't know him at all, but I'm going to go listen to him. And during his presentation, he said, I'm sure you think my job is to create great performances for junior sailors. But he said, it's not. My job is to win Olympic medals. And I thought, I'm really curious here. And he said, the way I do it is my job is to create an Olympic pipeline. I need to keep as many sailors involved in the sport as possible. Because until the kids get to be 17 years old and are at youth world's age, there's zero correlation between results and Olympic medals. And in Opties, there's actually a negative correlation. So he said Ben Ainslie was a crap Opti sailor. So he said, we're not looking for Opti results. Our job is to keep kids, you know, having fun and teach them. And our job is to keep parents helping the coach and to leave their kids alone. And clearly that's, you know, it's not just the Olympic team that wins Olympic medals. It's the whole junior program. And the RYA, unlike other federations, has what seems to me like, you know, an American, as a very influential position with sailing clubs and yacht clubs in the UK, in that they certify the sailing program, the coaches, instructors are RYA certified. So, you know, there's a way that they want them to instruct the sailors, to handle the parents, to run the program. And it keeps kids involved. Where in the U.S., a lot of the yacht clubs are more powerful than U.S. sailing. And the parents run the yacht clubs and the parents want the kids to perform in opties. So, you know, a lot of great opti sailors in the U.S. get burnt and go on to other sports. And I remember writing an article, a little tongue-in-cheek thing, was of how I would create an Olympic champion, as if I wanted my kids to be Olympic champions. And my first thought was, I want them to be Optimus World champions. So I went back through the, remember there are 50 Opti Worlds from back then. And I didn't even realize until I looked at it that the only Opti Worlds winners from the U.S. were James Larimore and Doug Bull. And Doug Bull was my summer camp instructor at Coral Reef Yacht Club, and he never told us. So anyway, back then, 50 Opti Worlds winners, 2 Olympic medals out of those 50 sailors. Wow. So huge, huge negative correlation.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just one of the steps. And clearly the British team is well-funded, which allows the Olympic directors, Sparky or Mark Robinson, when you come up with an idea that's going to make a difference that needs to be funded, most of the time they say yes and not no, because it's possible. And, you know, the other big thing is that, you know, the funding program allows most of the athletes that show great promise to make sailing their career rather than their pastime or their profession. So they can actually be Olympic athletes instead of taking time off to be Olympic athletes.
Which kind of leads me on quite nicely into something I was thinking about a few weeks ago. I was in San Francisco with SailGP, and there was a lot of talk of pathway. And when I knew we were going to do the podcast interview, I knew I wanted to ask you about this. I interviewed CJ Perez, who came up through Open Bic. She's 18 or 19 years old at this stage. So she doesn't have a long career behind her in sailing. I think she's only been sailing 5 years. But she's obviously had a large degree of success in the WASP, and now she's with Jimmy Spithill on the back of the American SailGP boat. She's just bought a Moth, and she wants to win the Moth Worlds eventually. And, you know, I don't know if you've met her, but she's pretty confident, driven individual, so I wouldn't bet against her, quite honestly. But I asked her about the Olympics. I said, so no interest in the Olympics? And she kind of said, well, you know, if they had boats that I was interested in sailing, then I would be all over that. But they just don't. So she has dismissed this completely. The Olympic path is just something she's not even considering. And I wonder whether we're going to see more and more of this if we don't upgrade the boats within the Olympic program. So that was a long speech by me, but what do you think?
Yeah, well, I haven't had the pleasure of meeting her, but certainly if she hangs around with Jimmy Spithill, she is going to have confidence, because he exudes that. And it's a great opportunity for her, for sure. And, you know, we're all lucky in that this is a life sport. So, and there's a lot of great opportunities to find out what fits you and what's going to work for you. Like Kevin didn't start sailing until he was 17, I don't think. He was one of the top ranked tennis players in Florida, in the U.S., forget that, in the U.S., and at 16, and he grew a better part of a foot in a year, threw off his timing, kids beat him that never beat him before, and he said, screw this, and he was hanging around Coral Reef Yacht Club, and ran into Steve Benjamin, and Steve didn't have a crew that day. And he goes, you look like the right size. You want to try 470 sailing? And that was it. And Paul Forrester, 3-time Olympic medalist, his first organized sailing was in university. So we're in a sport where you don't need to be an opti sailor to a great opti sailor to win Olympic medal. You can start late and still overachieve. So we're lucky to have that. And I'm sure totally diverge from your question here.
Well, I'm interested to know what you think about the classes that we're racing now. You know, boats like the 470. We've seen the demise of the Finn. But these boats
so
have been around a long
time. So you're
going to
get me into trouble, Justin, because, you know, clearly I'm one that says what's on my mind, and on my mind is what's best for the athletes. Because at the end of the day, they own this sport, not the administrators, you know, not the federations, not World Sailing, but, you know, but they think they own the sport. But, you know, at the test event in 2015, before the medal race, I'm often outspoken in the team leaders meetings. And I saved up a few days of not saying anything and not even attending the morning meeting. But I went the last day and had a lot on my mind and had bounced ideas off other great coaches. And, you know, I looked around at the crowd and I said, a lot of you have been doing this longer than I have. And I saw a lot of nodding. And I said, I've been asking myself, why do we do this? And because it's a huge amount of time away, sometimes for 8 years at a time with little or no success. But the reason we do it, I decided, and I told them the reason I decided I do it was because I want to be close to or part of a great performance. And a lot of heads nodding. And, you know, I looked at the administrators up on the raised stage and I said, you guys get to make a lot of influential decisions about what happens in our sport. So if all you do is think about, is my decision going to create a great performance or detract from it? And use that as, you know, the biggest part of your decision. I think this sport is going to keep going forward. But, you know, I'm not sure what goes through a lot of the decisions. Clearly, a lot of them are politically motivated. And, you know, there's a lot of self-interest with different countries thinking, I've got a favorite in that class. I want to get that class into the Olympics so we can win a medal this time. And clearly, with all the foiling stuff now, a lot of the past pathways with traditional boats have imploded. And the, you know, the Duncan Truswells and junior program guys are now going, whoa, you know, what do we do now? And from being in Weymouth in late 2020 and early 2021, you know, they quickly pounced on the foiling stuff because the harbor was full of kites and IQ foils. You know, so the Brits didn't lose a beat from what I saw. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's in the best interests of our sport or the sailing, but I'm also not privy to, you know, whether this makes a difference on whether our sport stays in the Olympics or not. Because years ago, I had a long talk with Paul Henderson and he said, sailing's never going to get kicked out of the Olympics. He said, we're not at that threshold of disinterest from the board that votes on it. So he goes, there's no panic, but you know, I'm not privy to any of that.
For sure.
I just want what's best for the sailors. And if the fleets are small and the classes aren't universal across countries across the globe, I don't think we're making a great decision because, you know, while the offshore idea seemed like a good idea, it was wildly expensive, and that pretty much guaranteed there weren't going to be many countries involved. And I don't think that's right for the Olympics. We're trying to drag as many countries and as many athletes into the experience as we can. And that's what gets great support for our sport.
Good answer. So let's round this up. What's ahead for you in your role of coaching, or maybe even heaven forbid that you do some of your own sailing? What have you got over the next 12 months?
Let's see. Well, last year I had great fun. I've been sailing Melgus 20s a lot, and won two worlds with Drew Freitas and Charlie Smythe, with Vince Bruhn coaching us. And that was just a joy. You know, three great friends, amazingly well-organized program. And now Drew has a Melgus 24. Vince still coaching us. Charlie's still on the boat. And now we have Federico Michetti. I don't know, what is he, 12-time Melgus 24 world champion. So that's a joy to be part of. And I'm racing on J70s as well with wonderful team and nice people. So the big difference there is how much more physical the Melgus 24 is, and how hard you have to hike, and the fact that you have to weigh in. So great sailing in both boats, but one's a bit more demanding than the other.
And any Olympic programs on the horizon?
No, not yet. And the whole Tokyo scenario exhausted me. One was the challenging travel involved. And I'm lucky that I have an Irish passport, so I was able to circumvent a lot of the roadblocks getting over to Europe from the US early on, which was fine. But, you know, the Tokyo Olympics was a burden to the athletes. And apart from the medal winners, the rest of the athletes got cheated from the Olympic experience. At least the medal winners have the medal to show for their efforts. But without the interaction at the regatta and seeing the public, and, you know, Enoshima and Tokyo are amazing places, and the Japanese people are so darn welcoming, the athletes didn't get to feel that. They didn't get to see athletes in other sports. So, you know, while it was still, I'm thrilled they still did the Olympics for the athletes. It was not your normal, like, Olympic experience, and it paled in comparison to previous ones as far as the enjoyment went. So I'm not in a rush to get back involved.
It's put you off a little bit, sounds like.
Yes and no. I mean, I there's no question that Marseille is an amazing place to sail, and, you know, I still see it in my future, but you know, I'm not in a rush to get on the horse without, you know, the right circumstances. And I luckily have wonderful, wonderful teams. I coach the platoon 52, and I have for, I think it's the last 5 years. And the Charisma RC44, and, you know, wonderful owner drivers, amazing, consistent teams on board with great sailors. And, you know, I try to work as hard as they do, and I put in 12-hour days, 16-hour days. So it's all worthwhile, because, you know, we get the results, and we keep getting better all the time, and the rest of the fleet pushes us. So it's a joy to be involved in those professional teams.
Well, it's nice to interview somebody like you who's enjoying what they do so much, and have been for a long time. So, Morgan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been really interesting, and very much appreciate it.
And, well, thanks for all your patience with my stories, Justin. I just hope I got across how much I enjoy this sport, and I hope my enthusiasm rubs off.
I think it always does. Morgan, thanks so much.
You got it. My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Morgan Reeser for spending time with me, and thanks also, as ever, to all of you for subscribing and listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another great guest from the professional sailing world, and until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.